We're speaking about diversity, the 70 faces of orthodoxy. I think we have a motto within our parsha of how to understand the balance of the 70 faces, the 70 approaches of understanding people and understanding Judaism in general. I'd like to focus in on one particular verse, which I think best describes the paradigm I'd like to focus in on today. The parasha deals with, as we know, the brachos, the blessings that were given by Yaakov Avinu to his 12 children, the Shiftei Kah, the 12 tribes. At the conclusion of the blessings, we have a very interesting and really a fascinating verse. The verse says, it's the source number one, after all these are the tribes of Israel 12, and this is what their father spoke to them, and he blessed them. He blessed each according to its appropriate blessing. So at first glance, this verse is very difficult. What is this verse coming to add? We just went through what the specific blessings were for each and every tribe. And then almost in summation, the Torah is telling us that this is what his father spoke to them, this is what he blessed them. Well, I understand that. That's what he just did. And then more particularly, which is redundant, he blessed each according to his appropriate blessing. Would I think that he didn't bless them according to their appropriate blessing? What is this last phrase coming to add? And more particularly, I think we need to understand the question that the Limudei Nisan, as well as many others, ask in 2a. You're telling me that each and every one of the tribes received a blessing. Is this really so? If we take a look at the blessings that Yaakov Avinu gave to his children, Reuven is blasted, Pachas Kamayim, you're unstable as water. Do I call that a blessing? Shimon and Levi, Arura Pam Kiaz, we curse their anger. Is that a blessing? So here the verse is telling us he blessed each according to his appropriate blessing. Question number one, did each one really get a blessing? If I look at the text, it's not clear that each one was blessed. And question number two, what is this phrase, he blessed each according to his appropriate blessing, adding? Do I not understand that each one was blessed according to his appropriate blessing? This last question, that each one was blessed according to his appropriate blessing, I think can be further explained based on a beautiful idea of Rabbi Yehuda Leib Eger in Teres Emes in Source 2b. Teres Emes explains the following. He says that this verse really doesn't only culminate the blessings of Yaakov to his children. It's a beautiful culmination of the entire book of Bereishit. For how does the book of Bereishit begin, explains the Teres Emes? Bereishit bara Elokim, and as we know, the Mefarshim, the commentators explain, it begins with the letter Beis, because Beis is a symbol of bracha, of blessing. And specifically the letter Beis too, because you can never have a blessing as a single individual. You need two for a blessing. The Torah begins with a Beis, hinting at the concept of blessing, but it's blessing in a hidden format. It's just a Beis. And then as the creation story continues, the animals are blessed, then people are blessed, and ultimately the Shabbos is blessed, and the creation in general is blessed. Ah, says the Teres Emes, but the blessing was held in a general format. The world is blessed. But it doesn't come into fruition that the individuals in the world are able to take this blessing. Where do we find the individuals able to actualize this blessing that the world was blessed with? That's in our verse. We wait generations till Abraham. And then we have to work through Abraham's children till we get to Yitzchak, Yitzchak's children to Yaakov, and then ultimately the book ends with again the concept of blessing. This is the culmination of the book. We begin with a base of blessing and potential. The base ends with the blessings in actuality. Each one of the tribes are blessed. But here says the Torah Semes, and this is a beautiful idea at the end of 2C. What does it mean, this phrase that we're troubled with, Ish Asher Kibirkato Beirachotam, three lines from the bottom in 2C. He explains, Zeromez Alko Pirtea Nishamot Chietzumihem. It's not only a blessing for the 12 tribes, it's a blessing for each and every one of us who've come from the 12 tribes. Shiatzlichu, that will be successful. Gam Kein Lafik Ritzon Mehashem, to get graciousness from God. V'yismach Hashem b'masav, and God will rejoice in His creatures. Explains about Torah Emes that Ish kibirchato beirachotam, each according to their appropriate blessing, He blessed them, means that it wasn't only them that He blessed each and every one of us as well. Which further begs our question, what is the nature of this appropriate blessing that we, until today, are benefiting from this blessing? And that's what I'd like to try to understand today. What exactly was the blessing that Yaakov Avinu gave to his children? How do we characterize this blessing? So I'd like to present today what I think is a fascinating model based on the writings of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. And it's based on a model that's found in a totally different section of the Chumash, but deals as well with the concept of the 12 tribes. It's a section which is found in the end of Parshat Nasa. The Torah tells us that on the day of the inauguration of the tabernacle, the Yom HaKamat HaMishkan, the Nesim, the leaders, the princes of each tribe, brought two gifts to the tabernacle. Let's watch the gifts because they're very, very interesting on the nature of these gifts on a philosophical and symbolic level. The verse says, this is source number 3, the Nesiim of Israel, the heads of their clans, brought their offerings before God. What were their offerings? 6 covered wagons and 12 oxen. A wagon for each of the 2 Nesiim, and for each one an ox. So the first gift that was brought was each Nasi, each prince brought an ox, and with the ox he brought, pairing up with one other tribe, a wagon. So we have 2 wagons, 2 oxen for each wagon. That was the first gift. They were able to transport the materials of the tabernacle. And then the second gift, continuing in source 3, and the Nesiim brought other offerings to the decoration of the altar. The one who offered his offering on the first day was Nachshon, the son of Abinadav, and it lists in detail what his offering was, a silver dish, weighing 130 shekels, a silver bowl, and every day, for 12 days, each one of the princes brought a gift to the tabernacle, and as the Torah notes, the gift was exactly the same down to the last measure. We have 2 gifts. Gift number 1 was each one brought an ox and shared together a wagon, and gift number 2 was they each brought sacrifices and gifts to the tabernacle, each one brought one on a succeeding day for 12 days, and although each one brought a different sacrifice, they were exactly the same in content. What's the significance of this? So here, Lubavitcher Rebbe says something very, very powerful. He says, this is the model, and it's the model I'd like to deal with today, of diversity and unity within the Jewish people. He says in source number 5, Israel is God's one nation on earth, comprised of individual human beings, each with his own distinct mindset, character, temperament, talents, and aptitudes, yet united by a common essence and calling. Continuing in 5, there are 2 aspects of the vision of an assemblage of individuals as a singular entity. There's interdependence and inherent synonymy. What does this mean? So he says in 6, interdependence, because we share a common goal and because we each have a crucial role to play in the achievement of this goal. Millions of diverse individuals complement and fulfill one another to create a single entity. In other words, the differences themselves are what create the unity. Since the entity Israel and what it stands for would be incomplete or even a single Jew to be missing from the equation, no Jew is fully Jewish without his relationship with every other Jew. The first level is a level of interdependence, which means that each and every one of us is unique. Each and every one of us has different temperaments, different mindsets, different character traits. Sometimes we say, thank God that no one else is like me. But be that as it may, we're each different. What is the beauty of the Jewish people? The beauty of the Jewish people is how each individual who is unique, who represents their own characteristics and their own potential, when they join together as a group, when they form together one collective unit, that's the beauty of the Jewish people. How every individual is able to contribute something unique to the whole community, and without this individual, something is missing from the community. And that's exactly what the first gift represents. Source 7, this is what the Nesiim demonstrated with their gift of 6 covered wagons and 12 oxen. A wagon for each 2 of the Nesiim, and for each one an ox. True, we are comprised of various tribes, each distinguished by its particular character. Yet, we recognize that while we each have been blessed with something our fellow tribes do not have, it is they who provide us with what we lack. Half a wagon is useless. We must combine our gifts in order to have something with which to transport the tent of meaning in our journey through the spiritual desert that is our material world. And while we may perhaps be able to produce a complete ox by our own efforts, it takes 2 oxen to pull our common wagon. The first gift is a very, very beautiful gift on a symbolic level. Its saying is that wagon has to be a shared wagon, and the oxen that are going to pull that wagon have to be shared oxen. Yes, I can produce my own ox, but I can't pull the wagon, I can't achieve in life unless I have another ox, unless I join together with the community to fulfill my obligation and to create a Jewish people. That's the first level. But the second level is that much deeper. The second vision of unity posits that underneath it all, the many and diverse vocations and personalities that make up the Jewish nation, but they are all expression of a single essence. It is not only that all these lives combine to form a collective endeavor, but that they are originally and intrinsically one. The nation of Israel is a single soul shining through a many-faceted prism. While each facet unleashes its individual collage of hues and the rays it reflects, the light they are all convey is one and the same. This is a totally different level and a much deeper level. The first level, we are all different, and it's the differences when brought together that form unity. On this level, we start off as one. It's the one ray of light. There's a common bond, a common unity among all of us. It's only the way it is refracted that it comes out that we are so different. Our essence is one, but that essence is exhibited in so many different ways and fashion. And this is the idea expressed by the second group of offerings brought by the Nesiim. The offerings were all exactly the same, down to the weight of silver in each plate. And 9, this explains the 12-fold repetition of the tribe's gift. The Torah wishes to emphasize that each tribe brought its own experience and perspective to its offering. The very same act was differently colored by the individual nature of each of its actors. But basically, it was the exact same offering. It had the exact same point of departure. It just manifested itself differently for each tribe. And that's why he says in 10, in summary, with their first offering of 6 wagons and 12 oxen, the Nesiim express how our differences, when applied in concert and harmony, themselves create a unified people. The second group of offerings expressed a much more profound unity, that even as we pursue our divinely ordained role, each living his life on his day in his way, we are all doing the same thing. For an origin and an essence, we are one, and our individual lives and accomplishments are the many expressions of a single quest. The basic difference between these two approaches, between the first approach that we're all different and we work toward a unified goal, or the second approach that we're all the same And that which we do is really all the same, but we just do it in slightly different ways, has a big difference in terms of accomplishment. And this he explains in conclusion of this part of the essay in source 11. The first aspect of our unity concerns only the end, but not the means. The ultimate purpose of it all is a singular, unified existence. But as long as we have not visibly attained this goal, we are separate and apart. As long as each and every one of us works on our own part in our own lives, and we're not focused on how we can give to the group, and we're not focused that we need the group in order for each of us as an individual to develop, so we remain apart, even though we have an ultimate goal of unity. However, according to the second approach in 12, the second aspect, however, demonstrates our intrinsic oneness even before our individual paths have converged upon the same destination. It demonstrates how the process of life itself, as we each apply the talents and abilities that have been granted us, constitute a single endeavor to make our lives a tent of meaning, a place to house the all-pervading truth of God. This is the model that I'd like to develop today in the brachos that Yaakov gave to his children. On the one level, as we'll see, each individual tribe is unique, forming to one whole, or they're all the same, yet expressing it differently. One final point before we move into the blessings, to explain this latter idea, is a very famous selection from the Baal HaTanya, the 32nd chapter. One remembers it easily because 32 is the gematria of Lev, of heart, and it's a chapter where he speaks about the love of fellow men. And he says, in source 13, one needs to understand that actually we are all equal. We all have one father, one source. It's on account of this common root in the one God that all of Israel are called brothers in the full sense of the word. The only difference is that the bodies are distinct from each other. And this explains how it's all possible to demand that one love his fellow as he loves himself. Self-love is innate, natural to man. Love for one's fellow is not. How can a generated love match a natural one? According to the principle stated here, this is readily understood. One Jew need not create a love for another, because the love is an inborn characteristic of his soul, on account of its root in godliness, which is common to all souls. It is as natural as the love between brothers. What does it mean to love someone else like myself? It's not difficult. Why? Because we all share one common father, one soul. We are all l'chelek elokam mimal. We all derive from the same source. The only difference is that our bodies physically separate us. But in reality, we are one. And if we view the world as one, and that we're just distinct in our bodies and the way we portray ourselves to the world, so that leads to a lot less conflict within the world. It's not that a person is different, they just express the differences in different ways, but ultimately we are all connected, we are all one. And that's why he says, and it's really true if we take it to heart, he says, why is it so difficult for us to love each other like ourselves? It's not easy. We have difficulty with it. He says the reason is simply, therefore, there can be no true love in fraternity in 15 between those who regard their body as primary and their soul secondary, but only a love based on an external factor. Since the body separates us from each other, whereas the soul is that which binds us together, the greater value one places on his body at the expense of his soul, the more conscious he is of the difference between himself and the fellow, and these differences require that he create a love for his fellow. A created love can never equal a natural innate love. Why? A, because it's limited to the importance of the motivating factor, and B, it's destined to endure only as long as that factor is valued. Once you pin that love on something external and you focus in on the body, that which separates us, not that which unites us, you've caused a disparity between people. If we take this model, the model of diversity which leads to unity, or the model of unity which is reflected in diversity, I think we will find what the blessings of Yaakov Avinu to his children were all about. The first level, the level of diversity which leads to unity, is found in Rashi, which is in Source 16. Rashi explains that the text should have said, each according to his blessing, he blessed him. Why does it say he blessed them? Why does the text say he blessed them? It is because the collective blessing benefited every single one. And every single blessing benefited all the brothers. Explains Rashi as well as other Mefarshim as follows. Ish kibirchato, each according to his blessing, he blessed them, means that after he finished speaking to each an individual tribe, he then gave them a general blessing. And part of that general blessing is that each and every one of you is dependent on each other. And this Rav Gedalia Shur and Or Gedaliahu developed so beautifully. He says the concept of bracha is expansion, but I'm limiting the expansion to the fact that you work within a group. The greatest blessing is that you're able to develop yourselves among the group of Klal Yisrael, among the group of Israel. How does this manifest itself? We find in Source 18 very simply, the blessing is not uniform. It varies according to the character of each child. So the Jewish nation is founded on the principle of unity and plurality. Each of the 12 tribes is called upon to perform its particular function, resulting from its special character and its regional location in the land. Each one of the brothers is giving a blessing, whether it's Yehuda who has kingship, whether it's Zvulun who has trade, whether it's Yisachar who is learning Torah, whatever it may be. But what's the beauty? The beauty is that you each give to the fellow tribe that which you have. That each one got a blessing specific to him means it was specific to him in order to give it to others. And here the Sifti Chaim says so beautifully, there's a very big danger in life. And he says in Source 19 at the bottom, Source 20 really at the bottom, he says there are two dangers. Danger number one, if we look at our own lives, we see this to be true, is that a person may say, I don't need anybody else. The path that I have, the blessings that I were given, makes me special, makes me unique, and I can serve God just using that path. I'm independent. I don't need anybody else. Comes along Yaakov Avinu and says, wrong. Each one got a blessing that was dependent on each other. If you want to really create godliness in this world, you have to understand that your path is special. And you have a unique gift given to you by God. Ah, but what's the beauty of your gift? If you're able to take your ox and join up with another ox and pull the wagon together. No one should say that my gift is so special that I don't need anybody else. Second problem is a person may say that my gift is so special I can use it in any way I want to. No. The gift is given to be shared. According to this approach, the concept of bracha, the blessing that Yaakov Avinu gave to the tribe, as explained by the Sforno in Source 19, is he gave them kelim lavodat Hashem. He gave them the vehicles with which to serve God. He gave them the character traits. He gave them that which makes them unique, whether it's a good feel, whatever it may be, the ability to rule over others. He gave them, he pointed out to them, that which makes them unique, the blessings that they have in order that they can share it with others. That's a simple level. And that's a level I think most of us, when reading this section, understand it to be. That the tribes work, although they are diversified, they work in sync, they work in unity, and we need all 12 tribes in order to bring godliness down to the world. But I think there's a much deeper level of what the bracha that Yaakov gave to his children are. And here we understand bracha on a totally different level. And this is found in Tzfas Emes, in Source number 22. Explain to Tzfas Emes a beautiful Hasidic concept that we're familiar with, wherein he says that each individual really lives with two souls. All of us. If we would look straight up above where we're sitting, we would find a soul upstairs in Shemayim in heaven. And this is a soul that is who we are, who we can be, the real us. And then we look back down here, and we take a look at ourselves. And this is called who we are. And we will note, if we look carefully, that there's a little bit of a disparity between what's up there and what's down here. And our lives, basically, is to try to reach the level that God had in mind when he brought down me and my soul into this world. And that's the understanding by the Akedah, by the binding of Isaac, when he has that knife in his hand, and the angel calls down and says, Avram, Avram, right? Al tishlach yadchal anar, don't touch the boy. And the obvious question is, why waste words? Every second counts. The knife is about to hit the child. So why repeat Avram, Avram, repeat it twice? So the answer is, what the malach, the angel, is saying is something very deep. Let me tell you something, Avram, at this moment, let's catch the moment. The Avraham of above and the Avraham of below have met. That's the ultimate. And that's why really after that, Avram walks off the scene. Because this is what we need to strive for, that the personality of below and the personality of above should meet. That's the Sfasem. If you want to know what bracha means, that's what bracha means. Bracha is the blessing to try to help a person bring down the inspiration of above into the figure of below. Bracha is the concept of self-knowledge, that you know who you are, and if you know who you are, you have the ability then to focus yourself to bring down the above into below, to have the Avram Avraham to match the two. This blessing of self-knowledge I'd like to develop a little bit because it's a fascinating concept. From this and outwards, I found Limudei Nisan explains this concept of self-knowledge that was given by Yaakov to the tribes based on a verse in Yisachar's blessing. In source 23, in the first line, we have the blessing given to Yisachar, which says, Vayar minucha kito, he saw the peace that it was good, Veta'aretz ki na'ima, and the land that it was pleasant. So what did he do? Vayen shichmo lispo vayhi lamas ovei. He put his shoulder underneath to carry the burden. Says from this and opera, there's something wrong here. We begin off the verse with a vision of peace, of menucha, of tranquility. Ki'aretz ki na'ima, it's pleasant. And because he saw it was pleasant, so he put a burden on himself. What's the connection? From this and opera, it says, and it's so true, there are two types of menucha, there are two types of peace. One is what we generally call a vacation. It means that you step out of your life, and you relax, and you forget about all the problems that you have. It was just away in Florida this past week. It was great. You don't think about anything. Life is wonderful. The problem is you come back, and reality hits. Nothing's changed. Nothing's left. All that was waiting for you before you left is waiting for you when you get back. That's one type of menucha. And there's a second type of menucha. This one we're not into as much. The vacations we can get into. What's this type of menucha? It's when you do that which you are supposed to do. And you are involved in all the different projects that come your way. And you do them, and you do them well. So then there's a feeling of menucha, there's a feeling of tranquility as well. And that's the beauty of Yisachar. When he saw menucha, what did he do? He said, I'm going to put the burden on me. That's the real menucha. The menucha means that what's the real tranquility about? That you're going to work. And you're going to realize that the way to achieve real tranquility is through hard effort. With this in mind, says Rav Nissen Alpert, the greatest way for a person to achieve this peace of mind in 24 is Shiachor Hadam al Mikomo Bechayim, that a person should investigate their place in life, Vilimso im Mikomo Bechayim, Vilaso Mashu Mesugal Lasot, to find what your potentials are and to develop them. And that's why he says in 25, we can understand the brachos that Yaakov blessed his children. Kikar habracha b'chayim, the biggest blessing in life, hu kishiyodea ha'adam en mekomo b'chayim. If you know your place in life, and therefore you know how to fulfill your mission in life. This was the blessing that in pachas kamayim, you're unstable. He's telling him, let me tell you something about your personality. And it's important for you to know that about your personality, so you won't even think to become a melech, a king, or a kohen, or a priest. Because that doesn't fit who you are. And the worst thing you can do for yourself and the rest of the Jewish people is to be involved in an area of life that doesn't fit your personality. So that was our original question. Where do we find a bracha by Reuven and by Shimon and Levi? So according to the first approach of Rashi, he gave them a general blessing at the end. According to this approach, it's a little bit deeper. And that is what the blessing is of self-knowledge. The blessing is, let me tell you what you're about. Let me explain to you the vision of above and the vision of below and how you can meet these two visions. And that's why he says, almost parenthetically, in source 26, that's why Ephraim was chosen over Menashe. Because when Menashe was born, what Yosef said was, I forgot my father's household. Let me put the past as the past. I don't want to deal with it. When Ephraim was born, he says, God has allowed me to multiply the Eretz Oni in this poor, difficult land. He realizes he's far from home. He realizes that the land he's in is not the real land. When you realize that you're far from home, when you want to come back, so then you'll be successful. If you want to forget about your home, if you want to forget about your past, you want to forget what your essence is, you'll never be successful. This idea of self-knowledge is developed in Rabbi Leff's book, Outlooks and Insights. And he explains a very powerful Gemara, which is found in the Gemara in Yuma 20b, where he says that prior to the death, the neshama, the soul, gives a scream that is heard from one end of the world to the other. Rav Chaim of Volozhin explains that before one passes from this world, God shows a person a picture of what he could have been had he developed all his potential and contrasted to what he actually achieved. When the neshama, the soul, sees the chasm between these two images, it screams. Why is it that the scream is described as from one end of the world to the other? Why not from the beginning of the world to the end? So he explains, based on an argument between Rav and Shmuel in the Gemara, how the Purim is coming up, now Hanukkah is finished, that Ahasuerus ruled from Hodu to Kush. So the question is, are Hodu and Kush right next to each other on the map? Or are Hodu and Kush across the whole universe? So the Gra explains, so one opinion is they're right next to each other, one opinion is they're far apart. So the Vilna Gaon and the Gra explains so beautifully, you know what, both are true. For any two points on a globe that are next to each other when traveling eastward, are at the opposite ends of the world when traveling westward. Hence, if a point on the globe is only seen as a point, it's insignificant. But if it is seen as the beginning of a far-off end, it encompasses an entire world. And that's why in 28, talents, abilities, and capabilities are points of potential. But if they remain an end in themselves, they are insignificant points. In the Shema, the soul cries for the failure of these points to grow and traverse the entire world. The development and perfection of this world depends on the realization of each Jew's individual potential. And that's why the famous Medrash that Yaakov wanted to reveal the Kates, the end, but he decided not to. So according to this approach, he's telling them something better than the end. Instead of telling them a date when the end is going to come, he's giving them self-knowledge, and with self-knowledge, they'll then have the ability to bring the end closer. And this, he says in Source 30, is the greatest blessing one can bestow, is to enlighten another and acquaint him with himself. Self-knowledge of one's ability and talents, as well as one's shortcomings and limitation, is the greatest blessing. It is a means enabling one to realize his divine mission in the world. According to this approach, it's really not 12 different blessings that were given to the tribe. It's really one blessing which is manifested in 12 ways. Every tribe got the blessing called self-knowledge. It's the model of unity, which is a prism which manifests itself, develops itself in different ways. Every tribe was given by Yaakov one blessing. Ish kibir chaso. Everyone got the one blessing they needed. That one blessing is a blessing called self-knowledge. How that manifested itself was different according to each one of the tribes, but it's really one blessing for all. But I think what we've seen so far today is that in life we have two models of unity and diversity before us. The first is the model of 12 different blessings, but we work together as 12 tribes in order to form one goal of bringing godliness down to the world. The second approach is that we start with the same blessing called self-knowledge, and we just develop that in different ways, but we're all working on the same path in life. This dialectic between the two ways of approaching the unity and diversity, I think, can be found in many other philosophical institutions in Judaism as well. Diversity which leads to unity, unity which is manifested in diversity. Time is brief, so I'll go through them briefly, but I think we can find both of these models in the famous Mishnah, which is found in the beginning of Pirkei Avos, Ethics of Our Fathers, on three things the world stands: on Torah, on Avodah, service of God, prayer, and Gemilut Chasadim, and service to other people, Chesed. On the first level of Torah, again, do very briefly, one's mindset can approach Torah on these two levels. On the first level, which is brought down in Source 31, one needs to understand that every individual has a chelik in Torah, a portion in Torah that no one else has. That each individual who learns Torah brings something new to Torah that no one previously and no one after them can understand, because it's based on who they are as an individual. So when we learn Torah, we approach Torah with one mindset. The first approach is that we have something special that we can glean from Torah through our own efforts. And this new understanding is something I will share with others. Or a second mindset, which is brought down in Source 32, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz and Sichos Musar, is that the Torah wasn't given to individuals, the Torah was given to us as a community, as a cloud. And when I learn Torah, I'm learning something that belongs to all of us. I don't have a monopoly on Torah. And then it's a collective Torah that I am learning, and it's with that understanding of a collective Torah that I'm learning, I will now bring my own personal understanding to it. But in this way, we focus much more on a collective unity among the people. No one has a monopoly on Torah study. In terms of prayer, according to the first level, this is brought down in Rabbi Soloveitchik's article, The Community, we know that the community is a community which is involved in prayer. Fifth line down, Source 34, the halacha has taught the individual to include his fellow man in prayer. The individual must not limit himself to his own needs, no matter how pressing those needs are and how distinguished he is. So on one level, when I pray, I think about somebody else who's in need, and I, as an individual, come to include that fellow person. And all my prayers are said in plural because I, as an individual, join up with another individual, and I don't only pray for myself, I pray for them as well. I remain an individual, but I join with other individuals through prayer to create a community. But then there's a much deeper level of prayer. It's not me as an individual that's praying, but I who pray am really praying as the entire Jewish people. And this is a fascinating idea I'd just like to spend a number of moments on, but I think it's very insightful. It comes from, again, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal's writing called The Synagogue Institution and Idea. I think in understanding this idea, we'll approach community prayer on a totally different level. The Rav explains that there's a verse in the Torah that tells us, "V'nikdashti b'toch b'nei Yisrael," that within all the people, in the midst of the community, will God be sanctified. You need the entire community for God to be sanctified. And yet, it's from this very verse that you need the entire community to be sanctified that our rabbis learn out that you can use 10 people to say Dvarim Shebikdusha, things of holiness. The question is obvious. If the verse is telling us what, that you need the entire people, so how can you then learn that's only talking about 10 people? It's enough. If the verse explicitly says, V'nikdashti b'toch b'nei Yisrael, you need the entire group, so how can I then learn that 10 people, a minion, is sufficient? This is what he says, and it's really very beautiful. He says, the answer lies on the last page, in source 36. In the self-evident fact that in permitting 10 people to recite Kedusha, we're operating with the idea of shlichus. The 10 are the representatives of the entire Jewish people. In a strange mystical way, they impersonate, not fictionally, not artistically, but existentially, and become Klal Yisrael. In other words, when 10 people in the synagogue offer their prayers, the entire Knesset Yisrael prays with them. They are the Knesset Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That is why Kedusha has been permitted in the presence of 10. It's not just 10 people who are praying. When 10 people get together and pray, they form the entire Jewish people. And he goes on to say, what does it mean, the entire Jewish people? It's not only the entire Jewish people who are around today. It's people who've lived in the past as well, as he says in 37. There's an invincible Knesset Yisrael which embraces not only contemporaries, but every Jew who has ever lived. It includes all those whose names have been immortalized and made unforgettable, as well as all the Jews who lived in anonymity, who died silently, and were buried in unmarked graves. All of them, great or small, big or little, are part of that and parcel of that invisible Knesset Yisrael, which is represented, and to be more exact, impersonated by the minion of 10 old, frail, sickly people. But furthermore, the Knesset Yisrael in 38 holds in her embrace every Jew who will ever live on the face of the globe, generations yet unborn, who will at some point in the dark or some future serve our people in a variety of ways. All of them belong to an invisible Knesset Yisrael, represented by the 10 people who on a rainy afternoon go to shul and say, Ashrei Yoshe Besecha. Who are the Ashrei Yoshe Besecha? It's the entire Knesset Yisrael. So on one level, I as an individual pray and I include somebody else. But on a much deeper level, what we're saying is that it's really a form of unity. We begin with unity. We begin with the concept that when a Jew prays, it's not just one individual Jew who's praying. You're really a personification of the entire Jewish people when you pray, and then your particular prayers are a manifestation of the entire community. Move from the esoteric to the concrete. In the final level of Gemilus Chasadim, I think we can walk away with a very practical lesson on these two levels. The first level of diversity, which leads to unity, is the level of Chesed. And as we know, Chesed means I give to the person that which they are lacking. So my friend needs advice, so I as an individual will be able to give my friend advice. They need a lift somewhere, so I'm able to give them a car ride. Whatever it is that they are lacking, I fill their lack. That's what Chesed is about. Chesed is filling lack. I, as an individual, see someone is lacking something, and we join together in unity, and I serve their needs, and they serve my needs. But then there's a much deeper level of Chesed. And here, Rav Wolva in Alei Shur points out, in his Kuntres on Chesed, in his section on Chesed, he develops many different levels of Chesed. And then he says, at the end of his essay, there's one last level of Chesed, which is the hardest level to achieve. And that's the level called Nosei Ba'ol Im Chaveiro, to join with the yoke of somebody else. This, he says, is the key of love between one's fellow man. What does this mean? So in 42, we have Rabbunim and Ethics from Sinai. If you see someone in trouble or pain, you may feel a pang of pity and realize you ought to help him. Then you feel sympathy, but you still stand outside the situation and regard the other objectively. So, normally speaking, we see somebody in pain, it's that first model of diversity which leads to unity. I can help this person out. Gee, it's a shame. I'm so sorry to hear that. But I'm not identifying with the person. When you bear a yoke with your fellow, you see and feel everything he does. You share his burden, sense his pain and suffering, because you have made his plight your own. So you must help him. And that's why in Rabbi Twersky's new book, Twersky on Spirituality, interesting title of a book, he quotes, Source 43, he quotes Rabbi Yerucham Levovitz, who states that this is even more demanding than the mitzvah to love another person. Sharing another burden means achieving so complete an identification with another person that his distress becomes your own. It's not only a question that I empathize or I sympathize with the person, but it's a deeper level, the model that we've been speaking about today of unity, which is manifested in different ways, where I actually feel in sync with that person, that their pain actually becomes my own individual pain. I can actually feel what that person is going through. The only way to achieve that is through beginning with the concept of unity and not beginning with the concept of diversity. Final point on this idea is brought by Rav Wolba, where he says that anosei ol im chaveiro, to share the burden, is not only in sorrow. He says there's a concept of sharing the burden, which he says, very interesting, is even harder than sharing it in sorrow, is sharing it in joy. That when someone's really happy, that you are really happy with that person. Not for that person, but with that person. And you really experience that same happiness that that person feels. That's totally being totally in sync with that person. He brings a beautiful story of Rav Avraham Grudzinski Zatzal, where he's once visiting his relatives in Warsaw. And he's sitting and talking with his relatives, and suddenly he looks up at the clock, and he sees what time it is, and he jumps up and begins to sing, and then he begins to dance, and for a whole hour he's singing and dancing. So his relatives thought he was a little bit strange. And when he finished this wild, ecstatic dancing after an hour, and he sits down, they said, well, perhaps you can explain this strange behavior. And he says that his student was getting married in Slobodka at that time. And when he looked at the watch, he saw this is the time the student was getting married. And he really felt the simcha, the joy of the student's marriage. So although he physically couldn't be there to make him happy, that doesn't mean he himself isn't happy. So he spent the hour expressing the joy that he felt over his student's wedding, even though he wasn't there. That's what we mean by joy. It's not only making the other person feeling happy, it's being in sync with their happiness, experiencing it as your own happiness. I think these two levels are brought to fore in a Rashi which is found way at the end of our parsha. Such a beautiful Rashi. End of the parsha, when the brothers are pleading with Yosef, have mercy on us for what you've done. And Yosef says, don't worry, it was really God who was orchestrating everything. I'm not going to harm you. So Yosef spoke on their hearts to try to appease them. The Rashi, in dealing with the appeasement of Yosef, gives a mashal, gives an example, which is quoted from the Gemara Megillah, which is found in front of us in Source 45. Amar Rabbi Yamin bar Yefet, Amar Rabbi Eliezer, Milamein shamar lehem varim hamitkablim al aleif, he told them things that would be appropriate to calm them down. What did he tell them? Uma asaran neiro lo yuchlu lechabot ner achat. Just as 10 candles cannot put out one candle, just like 10 brothers did not have the ability to knock off one brother, hayach ner achat, how is it possible for one candle lechabot asaran neiros to put out 10 candles? If 10 candles can't put out one candle, how can one candle put out 10 candles? We know clearly that any time the Medrash gives us an imagery, the imagery teaches us something. Why not use people? Why are we using candles here? But I think the imagery of candles is the imagery we've been developing today. On the one hand, as wrought in Das Torah Rav Yerucham in Source 47, Mitiv'am shel neirotu la'ir yachad la'azor echad ereyehu v'lo l'chabot. The nature of candles is that when you light one candle from another, you don't extinguish, you just add light. And the more light, the better. And the lights help each other to illuminate a room. And no light is jealous of another light. How come you light and I don't light? We all light. We all work happily together lighting. And I think this is the first model we spoke about, where each candle is a unique candle in and of itself, but each candle helps each other in order to illuminate, in order to bring down godliness into this world. And on this level, this is each one got the blessing unique for them. Each of the tribes got the blessing, which was going to be their kalim, the things that they were going to use in their service of God. But each and every one of those tribes had to work with another tribe, how to bring a carriage together, how to share two oxen together, because in life you cannot succeed by yourself. The first model is a model of diversity of many candles, but all lighting up a room, all bringing unity together. And although as a Jewish people we're very diversified, we all need to realize that we bring something unique, and together, and through Achdus, through community and unity, we can achieve tremendous goals, not by ourselves. But yet, there's a second understanding of what a light is about. And that is the nature of a candle. When one lights a flame from a candle, it's the very same flame, just on a different candle. And this is the model that we are all unified. We all have the same flame. As the Baal HaTanya spoke about, we all have that one soul. We are all one unit. We are all working for the same purpose. Our candles may look very different one from another, but the flame is the exact same flame. And this is the blessing that Yaakov gave to his children. Each one, he gave them the blessing of self-knowledge. Each one, he gave them the blessing of how can they bring down the upper image to the lower image. How can they combine these images to achieve their potential in life? Everyone got the same blessing, the blessing of self-knowledge. Each and every individual tribes are working along the same lines. It's just the way they work. The flame is the same. It's just the candles that hold the flame are different one from another. And there too, in this model as well, there's no room for animosity or diversity among people if we realize that we're all the same. We just manifest the sameness in different ways.